Hello, hello. Welcome to the Shropshire Witches podcast. I'm Alex.
And I'm Amy.
And today we are very excited because we have the wonderful and very knowledgeable Dr. John Callow. Hello, John. Thank you for coming.
Hello there. It's a pleasure to be here.
Great. Thank you. I'm going to pass straight over to Amy because Amy is always fantastic at doing these sort of quick intros. And go on, Amy. Why don't you have a quick kind of overhaul of our brilliant guest today?
So I think what I'd like to do is, if that's okay, John, is pass that over to you a little bit and ask you really to give yourself a little bit of an introduction to our listeners and tell you us a little bit about your research, because I think there's so much that I want to ask you, and I'm sure Alex feels the same. It'd be great to hear a little bit about your research in your own words first, and then we can go from there.
Okay, well, I guess my engagement with witchcraft began, a long time ago, more than 20 years ago now, at Durham, where I was doing my MA. And I had the luck and the pleasure to do a term paper with the incredible Jeff Scar, who was my tutor at that point in the philosophy department. And one thing led to another. And a few years later, we did a book together on 16th and 17th century witchcraft across Europe. And that was really my kind of way into this subject through his generosity and knowledge. Since then, I've done a cultural history of witchcraft, Embracing the Darkness, a study of the Biddeford witches, the last witches of England, about the last three women to be hanged for the offence. And I'm currently working on a short history of witchcraft, sort of everything you want to know in 170 pages for Bloomsbury.
Oh, I'd
So
love
that's where I am.
that. Wow. Yeah, that sounds really interesting.
Fantastic. Great. So, I suppose we should just take a sort of a nosedive in then, really, John, and kind of we'll just pepper with questions. Is that okay?
Absolutely.
Marvelous. Okay, great. So you mentioned the Biddeford witches, and I think that would be fascinating if you're happy to talk about that, and we'll sort of go a little bit broader with some questions as well. But I think the Biddeford witches would be a fascinating thing to talk about. I have some awareness, but not all that much, and that is actually because I've watched some talks with you on YouTube, so which I know sounds like a fangirl moment, but you know that's fine. So I wondered, could you give us a little bit of an overview of the Biddeford witches, and then obviously within that we can start asking some questions. But just if you were going to sort of give an introduction to our listeners, would you do that for us?
Yeah, absolutely. So, in brief, the Biddeford witches, the Biddeford Three, Temperance Lloyd, Susanna Edwards, Mary Trembles, are the last three women to be prosecuted and hanged for the offence in England. Now, often, I think for a popular audience, when people think about witchcraft, they think about it being conducted in a rural setting. They think about it being medieval. And very often, they think about it being the product of superstition and a popular outcry. None of these things happen in Biddeford. It's really late. So it's 1682. It's the summer of that year. Charles II is still on the throne. It's urban. They're in a rich seaport trading with the Atlantic. This is the age of the Royal Society and coffee houses, the scientific revolution. It's not medieval. And it was the elites and the well-to-do who initially brought the charges against the women. So, for all those reasons, I think it defies lots of the archetypes we have about the subject and the crime and witchcraft in general and the working of magic.
Okay, fascinating. And how much do you think, in terms of the sort of the let's look at the class system of it. So the idea of these women that didn't have much, and they were sort of I suppose harassed maybe by those that did. How much of that do you think was a part of it in terms of were they deemed to be a bit of a public nuisance, and this was something they thought would maybe eradicate that?
Absolutely. I think the story in Biddeford is about the haves versus the have-nots. The three women concerned were living in absolute poverty. When the justices sent the parish constables round, certainly into two of the women's abodes, they found little more than scraps, offcuts of leather that unfortunately had been pricked with needles. That, of course, they then tried to weave a case around to suggest that this had been the workings of sympathetic, harmful magic, you know, that the skin became the afflicted victim's, the leather rather became the afflicted woman's skin. So we know that they had absolutely nothing. They'd been in receipt of charity, two of them for more than 20 years. So there's ingrained poverty. They earn their bread by begging. They're at the bottom of the pile. And the thing about Biddeford is it's becoming a really, really stratified society, that the rich are getting richer, the poor are getting poorer. Charity and the charitable institutions aren't really coping. The women have got a name for themselves as being troublesome, and they're really pitched into a struggle with a younger group of women with young children who are socially above them, and they are childless through desertion and death, or just the fact, in the case of one, that they were unmarried, never had kids. And they are completely on the back foot in the social scale in terms of economic privation, in terms of education, in terms of a support network.
Okay, interesting. This idea is this sort of, I'm assuming, not exclusive to Biddeford, because this idea of witches or people that were nuisances, how much do you think these three women sort of fit the stereotype of what was going on across the country? So I know you say that it's later, but do you think this is something that is in a kind of class system as well, that is sadly typical?
Well, the stereotype's been there for a long time. You know, the stereotype of what the witch is, how the witch behaves, how the witch looks, has been gathering pace for about 200 years by the time we're looking at the women in Biddeford. There is a chilling account by Roger North, who was actually in the courtroom at Exeter and saw the women. And he says, as almost a kind of throwaway line, if you wanted subjects for a painter to, you know, paint as witches, then these three women would fit the bill perfectly because they were so decayed, gap-toothed, elderly, and garrulous. In actual fact, he gets their ages wrong. He thinks they're about 10 or 20 years older than they actually are. So you can get some sense of the effects of living on the streets, you know, just as today, and the way that it wrecked them physically and mentally.
I think that's so sad, isn't it? This idea of sort of somebody that's othered or ostracized anyway through, in no small part, not their own fault, is then sort of again separated. Amy, sorry, if you've got a question there, sorry.
No, I was just going to agree that
Oh,
it's, we
okay.
see a lot of this in kind of Shropshire accounts of Shropshire witches, is that there's such an emphasis on their age, the way they look, the fact that, and you get some really obscure accounts of like Becky Smount, who is said to have flown in 79 years ago. And in reality, she was probably only about 50 to 55 at the time of them writing, but the poverty and the dire situations that she would have lived in kind of a more agrarian setting, granted, really emphasize and are seen in the folkloric and in the historical narrative. So it is really interesting to see how that is a trope wider, and not just within Shropshire.
Absolutely. And you see where the net did spread in Biddeford. Two other women were brought in on witchcraft charges as well. But in their case, they were completely different in the sense that they had a support network of family and friends and money, and they were treated completely differently. They weren't sent to the town lockup. Their papers weren't sent up to Exeter for pre-trial reports. In fact, we don't even know the details of the charges against them because they were kept out of the town records, and the cases were made to go away in their case. So the real searing tragedy of the Biddeford, the three poor women, is that at any point, if one person had spoken up for them, there's probably quite a good chance they could have got off.
I think that's so sad. I mean, with cases like this, are they sort of flash in the pan? Is it something that is I don't want to say recidivists because they're not actually criminals, but you know, is this something that's reoccurring and eventually they're like, right, we're going to have to do something. Could you explain maybe that in the terms of judicial? I can never say that. How
Yeah.
that works for us? Could you explain that?
Well, bizarrely, the court records, if you look at people convicted of witchcraft, it does work out on average a sort of three strikes and you're out. That by
Okay.
and large, it's the third conviction that gets you. And that was the case certainly with Temperance Lloyd, who's referred to in the pamphlet literature as the Grand Dame or the Great Witch of the three, and she is the dominant, most clearly defined character of them. She had been in trouble years earlier. She'd been on trial for Exeter a decade before. There'd been other accusations flying around that were dropped simply because the family of the little girl she was supposed to have bewitched to death in the second case didn't want to take things further, and they believe rightly it was an outbreak of illness of smallpox that killed her, and not actually malevolent witchcraft. So it takes a long time for an individual in a community to get the name of a witch. But I think you can see that in a lot of these cases that there is an element of how charity and how begging works that we can relate to modern day, begging on the streets, unfortunately, that there are two basic paradigms you can move in as a beggar. It can either be absolutely passive. You think if you go to somewhere like the Czech Republic now, you'll see sort of living statues prostrate on the street with a cup before their heads and their hands upraised in a supplicant posture. Or you can be what a former prime minister infamously termed an aggressive beggar. And the three women in Biddeford alternate between these two modes rather, of begging for charity. And the problem with Temperance Lloyd is she can never get it right. When she wants to appear caring, she appears threatening. She gets everything wrong. Where she tries to threaten, she just gets herself into more trouble. I think there's probably an air where, and you see it very clearly in the parish records in Biddeford and the charity records, that there was quite a large number of the indigent poor, 60, 65 people on the parish relief in this port city, that women very often banded together when they begged. Now you can, it doesn't take a genius to work out why that happened, because it lessened the chance of assault, of sexual assault, of abuse. So they banded together with a sisterhood. Temperance Lloyd is different. She seems to be the kind of lone wolf. But Susanna Edwards and Mary Tremble certainly did accompany each other, and Susanna had begged with groups of other women before. But if we think about one of the key sort of flashpoints in the case, Temperance Lloyd for once gets a stroke of luck. She manages somehow to get a little basket full of apples, and she sits there trying to get a penny or two for them in the marketplace. A well-to-do mother comes past, her child steals an apple. Temperance Lloyd remonstrates. The mother thinks it's a great joke that her child's being cheeky and cute and spurns the woman. And of course, Temperance starts after her, curses her. The child falls ill within weeks and dies. And that misfortune is linked in the mother's mind to the effect of the curse. If we think about it today, the number of times we pass by somebody selling the big issue, you feel, I think most people would probably feel, an element of guilt if you can't afford it that day. So you have a guilt, just as a 17th century person would have, over your fortune compared to misfortune. I think the difference is today, the thing that stays with you are the mumbled words you don't quite pick up on. Now, in a 17th century context, that can become a curse. If other things start going wrong in your life, you transfer the guilt not onto the victim, if you like, and begin to attribute to them all kinds of malign and terrible things, because it makes you feel better, it gets you off the hook, and it explains a function of your own misfortune that had been present before. So you link one unrelated thing to another, and bingo, you get cases of witchcraft.
But that sort of projection and fear mongering is relevant today in whichever level, whether you look at immigration or something like that. It's still with us, just maybe not under the kind of the banner of maybe witchcraft. And I think the idea of a sort of slightly entitled mother with what presumably just actually, frankly, John, sounds like an obnoxious child.
Absolutely.
I'm saying this is someone with my children, but that child just sounds like product of its parents, maybe. But I think that's still something that resonates these centuries on, and I think this idea of kind of separation that they were treated like that, I think just feels very, very sad. But actually, the fact that it still goes on today, and maybe not under, as I say, the banner of witchcraft, but is still very much something where people are ostracized, namely because of things like the mercy of circumstance. I think it's really, really sad. And this idea that actually, that even though there was a separation of time, like weeks, but they still thought, you know what, it must be that woman who not only is vulnerable, but whatever else, it's her fault rather than sort of natural circumstance or things that are going on, seems like something sadly that is still quite relevant because people still do that, don't they? They still pen things to people who are less fortunate than them, and they're saying, oh, well, like the idea of people taking jobs and things like this that actually probably people maybe weren't sort of going up for anyway, but are getting a bit political. But it irritates me because I think that idea is still so present in 2025, and it's so frustrating.
And witchcraft is always political, either on a village level or on a state level, somewhere like Bamberg during the 30 Years' War. That in this case, the personal really is political. That the moment you begin to strip away a sense of society and class and politics and the othering of minorities or marginal people, because after all, witchcraft is a liminal, marginal occupation, both now and then, you lose the essence and the point of the whole thing. These things don't happen by chance. They happen because societies enact persecution in a particular way. And actually, to use a modern idiom, it's almost as if the traditional witch figure has swapped gender today. If you think about the rather strange middle-aged man who lives alone in a shabby house and maybe is a train spotter or something like that, you're actually getting into the same territory as, the woman who lives in the cottage on the outskirts of the village and keeps a load of cats.
I mean, that is actually me, John, to be honest, the last one. That
I didn't want to say it, but
is like that is
yeah.
that is actually
Well, I'm thinking about growing up on the edges of Merseyside in the 1970s, the village toughs, that there was a the village had an estate in the sense there was a lord of the manor, however antiquated that sounded. And in the middle of an quite a built up industrial area, Liverpool was 30 minutes away. You had there on the edges still thatched cottages because there'd never been an improving landlord. And one of the cottages was regularly targeted on Mischief Night or before Guy Fawkes Night by the village toughs because it was known as the Witch's Cottage. And that was simply because of an old lady who lived alone with her cat. Now that's 1975.
Shocking, isn't it? This idea, though, of stereotypes in terms of, I find it interesting. So if you look at this, the Biddeford, which is here. So that woman that I'm sort of fixating on a bit because she's irritated me. This sort of slightly entitled, but yeah, no, she's getting on my nerves a bit with her child. But the fact that she's playing a small but pivotal role as well, but she meets all the stereotypes of what makes people feel safe of being whatever, more affluent than those that she's sort of insulting or pinning things to, which is often the case. And this idea that she is a stereotype in itself that still exists, and today it's kind of like, tea pigs in gentrifying parts of London, but and wherever else. But I think that feels safe compared to the people that she's sort of projecting onto. And that's still something that's so prevalent. So how much of, because what I find interesting about witch trials is there's on one hand this sort of fetish, fetishizing, I can never, again, these are words I can't say, John, but fetishizing elements of it, like making, say, witchcraft today, when, as we say, despite being called the Shropshire Witches, which is slightly tongue in cheek, but this idea of sort of witchcraft being re sort of embraced and maybe against the patriarchy and things like this. But also the reality of it, because it feels a little bit bad taste, because how much of it do you think was done based on a class system? How much do you think of this stereotype, which seems to have prevailed, as the idea of maybe perhaps on one hand you had an old, either menopausal, postmenopausal, not that I'm saying that people who are menopausal are old, but you know what I'm saying, going into that stereotype of witches and the sort of Snow White witch, and then looking at the other side, which was younger girls, usually sort of housemaids, things like this, that somebody got their eye on, said no, or maybe they were interested elsewhere, and so the Lord of the Manor, if we're going to kind of look at that trope, sort of then focused and thought, well, if she's not interested, it must be witchcraft, or the hyper sexualization, like somebody like Anne Boleyn saying witchcraft. So which do you think is the most kind of common trope?
All of the above. If you think that let's start off with things at the very beginning. If you think that witchcraft by the late 16th century is a criminal offence in England,
Okay.
and where it is alleged, just as today, the authorities go and look around the crime scene. Now, in terms of who are the targets of witches? It's the child in the cradle. It's things to do with hearth and home, animals, the butternut churning, the horse has died in the stable, all that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So the suspects aren't going to be predominantly female because they're the people who are in the home for the most amount of time. Now, I'm not saying that misogyny doesn't play an overwhelming role in all this, because it absolutely does. But to set out the crime scene and think about the suspects, you get a view of witchcraft as a particularly and indeed spectacularly women's crime, in the way that something like poaching would be a male crime.
Oh, that's
Of
interesting.
course,
Okay.
the difference is we all know harmful witchcraft inspired by demons doesn't exist, whereas poaching did.
Yeah.
But I think that gives you some view that the danger about witchcraft accusation is like any solipsism. It works if you accept the basic tenets. And that's why it's so savage and cruel and plausible until a very small number of people stand up against it over the course of the 17th century, who tend to be, by and large, people like John Webster, who are the kind of misfits, the religious and political radicals who kick over the traces, the Royal Society under Glanville, et cetera, and even Boyle are quite enamored with witches. So it's not quite as cut and dried that the scientific revolution, waved its hand and all this disappeared. I think that the spec I think one of the spectacular things is the way that the witch figure, under the revival of witchcraft after the Second World War, the end of the witchcraft acts, the environmental movement, and the second wave of feminism, has been completely reshaped from a figure of terror, of degradation, into one that is empowering and positive. And I think it's one of the most remarkable transformations in terms of cultural history and the history of ideas I can actually think of.
No, that's fascinating. And I've got to ask, because I think this is so we're talking about the sort of the role of the witch. Jeanne d'Arc, or Joan of Arc, however you want to look at it. So Jeanne d'Arc, I would say, but this idea, so they had her coined as a witch. And
Yep.
I think it's right to say for wearing men's clothes as well as a trans
Yeah,
woman, which
absolutely.
yeah, okay. Now you're going to know more about this, but I know that and I thought it was fascinating because I've got to say I did hear you talk about this, and I thought it was interesting because I know in Shakespeare, because he is very witch-centric, isn't he? But also because, of course, we're looking at the time that he's writing for the most part under James the First as well, if you're looking at the English. So you're going to kind of warm to the theme a bit, aren't you? You're like, keep him happy, talk about witches because he loves that. But Jeanne d'Arc, this idea, because she's younger as well, I'm interested
She's
in.
dead at 19,
Yeah, I mean,
you know.
that's shocking. That is it 19?
And so, you know, this is one of my little things, that Jean Seberg gets a really bad rap for her portrayal of Joan, but I think she's absolutely brilliant. She gets it in a way, you know, other actresses haven't, because of her youth, of her wide-eyed belief. And I think it's a terrific film role of hers as a debut.
I'm going to look for that because I've only seen her be played usually by somebody sort of probably late 20s, a little bit, a little
And
bit.
it doesn't work. It
No.
doesn't work because she was that young. And someone with an absolutely meteoric career, who, as you say, is an arch villain for Shakespeare, because she's very much a witch there.
Oh, yeah.
And the Parliament of Paris, the lawyers, the clergy, had to run around and formulate a witch theory to send her to the stake in the marketplace at Rouen. And if you look at both because the why it is so riveting is because we've got a verbatim account of both her trial, and also the counter trial, when years later the French government and the king were trying to rehabilitate her. So we know what was said. So you can see the obsessions of her male accusers. Why did she dress like a man? They're obsessed with how the saints appeared to her. Did they have hair? Were they, I mean, in some ways, it's remarkably modern, because they're obsessed whether the saints as they present are binary or non-binary.
Yeah,
Were
okay.
they male? Were they female? Were they asexual? Did they change? What did they look like? What did they wear? And they managed to throw all kinds of nonsense at her. You know, the half-remembered fact that the peasants danced around an oak tree in the village of Domremy. All these things, you know, that becomes the tree of the fairies, that becomes linked to witchcraft. Her, you know, preternatural or uncanny ability to lead troops, to lead men, and to win spectacular victories are all bound up in this series of charges against her for flouting all the kind of norms.
It's extraordinary, this hyper focusing. So maybe for a modern example, but obviously with a less severe outcome, is perhaps Piers Morgan focusing on Meghan Markle, who just cannot move on with
Absolutely.
life. And you're like, Piers, maybe you need to take a day off. Why he gets time, I'll never know. But this sort of methinks the lady does protest too much, where they sort of hyper focus on everything they do, however tenuous, they'll find some link to something that they say, she's doing this, she's aiming at that. And you think, oh, for God's sake, there's got to have been, and I'm not kind of trying to, well, I don't think I am, I'm trying to put a sort of sexual slant on this, but given her age, and maybe I'm sort of doing the same narrative, I'm assuming because she's young, there has to have been some sort of sexual element to it, because I'm going to imagine most of the men making accusations are middle-aged or older. I don't want to kind of go for a stereotype, but there has to have been that sort of narrative, surely.
And clergy,
And clergy,
who
yeah,
of course are
well,
celibate.
exactly.
I think with Joan, I mean, they do attempt to concoct a rape for her. She is assaulted while she's under custody. Her virginity, you know, this idea of the virgin, La Pucelle, the maid,
Yeah.
is part of her. Myth is the wrong word, but it's part of her identity.
It is, yeah.
Marina Warner writes an amazing book about her, where she talks about the identity of La Pucelle, because she's not known as Joan of Arc in her own lifetime. But the idea of the Maid of Orleans, well, as Warner says it's a temporary state. One of Joan's problems, actually, it's almost the problem I think lots of very successful women have in the public eye, is how they transcend the aging process. That Joan is having, on the horizon are the problems about how she goes forward. She's been useful to the Dauphin. She's won all these amazing victories, but now she's gone too far. She wants to continue the war against the English. When she's taken, she's fighting effectively as a free captain. Most of her people have left her. It's only a handful of people like Gilles de Rais who stay with her till the kind of bitter end. And of
Gilles
course,
de Rais was a
he was her great commander. He was her mate,
he
which
was
is another
quite
fascinating
controversial,
thing.
wasn't he? Gilles de Rais was a bit with the old anyway. Sorry, John.
Well,
Gilles de Rais was
De
quite
Rais, I mean,
okay.
just to go off down on
No,
a tangent before we pull it
we've pulled
back,
off at this.
this is another thing. Gilles de Rais, again, is a very incredibly successful soldier. He's her confidant. He falls on witchcraft charges and child abuse charges
That I
and
know.
blood libel charges, which in actual fact mirror the crimes inflicted on the Jewish community in Europe. It's a recycled blood libel that gets Gilles de Rais. And I think really, he's somebody who hasn't been rehabilitated in the way Joan of Arc has.
No,
And
not at all.
again, you can see that her project was fundamentally threatening to society, as male society, as it was constituted. To get back into the sort of hypersexualization of Joan, her entire trial is rigged around male insecurity. The questioning is all about, why did you take male dress? Why did you cut your hair? Why do you behave like this? Do the saints who come to you have hair like you? Are they attractive? Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so you can see the preoccupations, and they all are along the lines of gender, of sexuality, all those kinds of things. And the very fact that they can't destroy Joan of Arc on the grounds that, she was sexually loose with the soldiers. She's a young woman of incredible, she's morally upright. They can't get her on that. So they try her on lots of things. So effectively, she recants and she goes to the stake because, she gets scared, which was understandable. She says that the voices were all fabrications. She agrees to readopt the dress of a woman, and then of course she goes back to wearing male clothes, which of course were conveniently left around for her in her cell. I mean, this is the kind of double jeopardy. She couldn't just have gone out and got herself a new suit of clothes. The authorities were really annoyed, and the English were furious. The Earl of Warwick is absolutely incandescent that she's got off the rap.
I didn't know. Fascinating. The Earl of Warwick as well.
Yeah, well, he sits in on the trial.
Oh, John, this is right up my
So,
street. So this is, gosh, okay. I had no idea.
ironically, had the English been a bit smarter, they'd have taken her recantation and published it and let her slip back to obscurity. Because the story is so weird. If you look at the counter trial, one of the fascinating things, and if I had world enough and time, I'd love to go and look at it in more detail, is that about 20 years later, Joan's father and her brothers get a false Joan who they parade around Normandy. She works miracles and they earn lots of money out of it. And they sort of go on a world tour. All on this until it's exposed. Joan escaped from the flames. So it's a very dysfunctional family. I think we can say that without a shadow of doubt.
I think
But
that's
there are all of these kinds of things. And the terrible thing about all this is We learn so much about what it was to be a woman, how the peasantry interacted, how village life worked through the trial records. You know, as a feminist historian once said, the savage but fascinating thing about European witch trials is we get to hear women's voices far more clearly through them than we do at any other point. And that's certainly true with La Pucelle.
It's so extraordinary, and I think with Jeanne, is this sort of idea that either she's sort of fetishized as this kind of young martyr, or otherwise she's problematic. And again, it's just interesting how these things sort of resonate. And I think the other thing as well is that sort of Gilles de Rais, I had no idea about that, nor the Earl of Warwick. And actually, Gilles de Rais, who I sort of do you remember? I mean, Amy, you're because Amy's quite a bit younger than me as well, but you're maybe a little bit too young. But John, this might be, I'm not aging you, but this might be more your area. But do you remember the Water Babies with James
Yes.
Mason? Yes, of course you do.
Yeah.
Classic. And do you remember the shark that was, I would say, almost certainly based on Gilles de Rais? Do you remember him with his, he's the one that kind of all the sort of the water babies are terrified of. And it's fascinating that in a way he's sort of become, so as soon as you said Gilles de Rais, but he's sort of become a little bit folkloric, despite also sort of
Absolutely.
quite fierce accusations and things that maybe if a woman had had those sort of accusations would not have maybe had almost romantic notoriety. It's extraordinary. And I find this idea and this hyper focusing on virginity and actually, and sorry, Amy, I'm hogging things.
No, it's fine.
It was a question, I know, because I'm getting like quite excited about all this, but it's the same thing when they focus either on somebody young and it's all about this sort of narrative of virginity, or they get older and they're sort of menopausal, postmenopausal, and they're all about sort of growths or things that maybe the devil or whomever can. I hate the word suckle because there's no way of saying that without sounding absolutely gross, but you know that they kind of, you know, they're obsessed with this idea of having growths or teats and things that something suckled off, and they're probably just things that come with being older, aren't they? Surely. But they said these were growths, and actually when you sort of consider what they did, it was a gross sort of sexual violation, wasn't it? It's an assault where they looked at these women, and I believe actually from one of your talks as well that something I hadn't realized was that this was public, because when you were looking at Matthew Hopkins and things like this, I hadn't realized that actually people watched these sort of, how would you describe them, these, well, assault really happening. I thought this was something that maybe one or two men, which is bad enough, but I hadn't realized that perhaps this was quite sort of such a public display. How common was this violation of violence, really, rather than violation of violence?
I mean, Aldous Huxley has the very telling phrase when he talks about in The Devils of Laodun, the account of the convent that was supposedly possessed, and the Mother Superior there, and he describes it as being like a rape in a public toilet. And I think that is the analogy I'm going to work with, however horrific and unpleasant that may be. That is actually the level of violence. So if we look in Biddeford, that, you know, how do you find a witch? You find them through their witch marks. What's a witch mark? It's a supernumerary teat where supposedly a familiar spirit, a little demon who could take the form of an animal, sometimes a big animal. In Biddeford, I mean, there are some crazy ones. Their familiar spirits ranged from everything from magpies to lions to pigs.
In Biddeford, lion.
Supposedly in Biddeford, yes, apparently a lion came and, you know, did the bidding of the witches. And this again leads you to this idea that the compact with the devil transformed the corporeal reality, the genetic coding of the witch into something that was less than human. That they were not as they had been. So this again, you know, once you dehumanize somebody or something, then it becomes less a matter of what you do to it. No, you know, the gloves are really off. So they look for witches' marks. Temperance Lloyd had been examined a decade earlier and they found nothing. 10 years later, when they examine her, they do find vaginal polypses on her and probably precancerous growths. And the poor woman has to submit to this at the town hall in Biddeford. And again, there is an element of class in this because they look for witches' marks and they look at the body of the Countess of Essex in her famous divorce case at the start of the 17th century. But when that happens with her, it's done behind a screen, it's done behind tapestries, and she has waiting women, to examine her. What this does lead you to, though, is midwives, contrary to the sort of popular trope, were more likely to be examining another woman for the witches' marks than actually, prosecuted as witches themselves. So this whole idea, this science of demons, all these solipsisms, have all these ways of catching people out. I mean, there's an account as well from one of the continental witch finders who talks about, one of the methods, and he describes his examination of this woman who was very coherent and denied everything. Then, when he had every hair shaved off her, he describes her trembling, and he says, well, the demons had nowhere to hide in the midst of her hair, and she became afraid and confessed to everything. And this again is a surefire way that we deal with people. So again, it's the dehumanization of the woman and actually the man. Going back to Lao Dun, Ken Russell's amazing film, where you have Oliver Reed, and he is absolutely dehumanized by the end of the movie.
It's a belter, and that's a name like a massive Oliver Reed fan. But that really disturbed people as well, didn't it? Like, people found that terrifying. I mean, Ken Russell had that ability to sort of shock but educate and fear. And yeah,
Well,
it's
it's a tour de force film, and the genius of it's Oliver Reed at his greatest because he
yes.
was an absolutely great actor.
Oliver Reed,
But
I'm obsessed with him.
my great uncle was his bodyguard for a bit, but that's another, yeah.
Oh, John,
Anyway,
we've stopped
there
recording.
you go.
Amy,
And
we
there's a story that hangs around that, how he got the
have
gig, but that's one for another day, maybe. But no, this was a man of incredible talent. If you think about that movie, you've got Derek Jarman's sets, which are amazing. Jarman has the intelligence, and he talks about this in some interviews that, when filmmakers think, want to set things in the past, they age everything. But to the people living at the time, theirs was modernity.
Yes,
Yeah.
exactly.
So Lao Dun, through Jarman's eyes, is new and sparkling and fresh. He also does a trick that he borrows off Eisenstein, the great Soviet filmmaker, where Vanessa Redgrave's character intrudes through tiny passages, and so she physically has to make herself small to edge through the sort of shrunken convent. But you've got this, and what Russell does brilliantly, if bearing in mind this is made in the early 70s, he has the witch hunter, the Inquisitor, as the sort of rock star character with the love beads and the absolute killer lines and killer looks. If he'd have been an unsubtle filmmaker, he would have made the witch hunter the figure of the establishment, boring, staid, besuited. He does none of those things because he understands intrinsically the impulse behind that the witch hunters were people who felt that they had a moral mission to reform manners and to save souls. And that's another reason why it's such a brilliant film.
It's and Amy, you would love it. I mean, it's quite like it's a bit of a rough watch, but it is it's amazing. And
But
he,
it has to be a rough watch because it's an adult subject. You can't take away the horror. It's like there's an amazing Belarusian film called Come and See about the Holocaust. And I
Oof.
think I've managed to watch it three times, and you see it from the eyes of a 7-year-old. And it's so incredibly harrowing. But you it and actually the point is, it's harrowing for a purpose and to take you on a journey of learning. It's not where we get to very, very often, I'm afraid, with popular art about the witch. that you end up into something that becomes torture porn.
This is
You
the
know,
thing.
this takes you back to your thing about Joan of Arc. It's you know, the ivory skinned martyr withering on the pyre, the vicarious watching of violence done to women. Now, Russell gets round that because the violence A is aimed at a man, you know.
Exactly.
But it's symptomatic of what was going on across Europe over a 200, 250 year period.
It's extraordinary, and it's kind of, I suppose, like anything, like wading through what's necessity and what's gratuitous. But I think they do it so well, and I think even the details, the kind of the shaved heads and things. I think he's a gothic Carol Reed is what he does. When you look at Oliver with the wet cobblestones and things, and Ron Moody, just the casting. But I think Ken Russell does that in abundance, and I think he is fantastic. So watch it. But I just thought I had to look at Amy straight away. As soon as you said Oliver Reed, I thought she'll be like, oh God. Because I am a huge, huge Ken Russell fan and a huge Oliver Reed fan. So you've gone right up my street. But Amy, look, I am hogging the floor here. You must.
No, it's fine. Yeah. Sorry, I was talking over you then.
All the talking. You go.
So I think it was really interesting for me. Well, all of it's been interesting for me, but it was really interesting when you were talking about the rehabilitation of the witch, because it got me thinking. I have been interested in witchcraft for as long as I can remember. And certainly there was two kind of influences for me on witchcraft. The first one was my grandfather's stories. I've spoken about it a little bit in the past. My grandfather was a typical Shropshire mon, and he told a lot of stories, none of them true, probably. For example, he said he met the devil on several occasions. But he put an image of the witch in my head that was very folkloric. It was very similar to the sort of stereotypes we've been discussing. And I think the second influence for me was films like The Craft, Sabrina the Teenage Witch, and that rehabilitation, that sense of empowerment that comes from witchcraft, that can come from a pagan path or a witchcraft path, or both. So this was a very long-winded way of me asking you, but what I'd like to kind of dig a little bit deeper about is, where did this rehabilitation of the witch kind of start, and who were some of the key kind of figures in this change from witchcraft being something inherently sinister to something that was more of a reverence for nature, an ecological kind of reverence, and also kind of an empowerment?
Okay, we got three main figures in the transformation. The first is a French historian called Georges Michelet, who's writing in the late 19th century, and he produces a book in very short time because he's just lost his job at the university. He's been politically persecuted by Napoleon III, and he needs to make some money. And he also wants to get his own back on the clergy. And he writes a stunning book called The Witch, where the witch becomes the embodiment of womanhood, and particularly a form of womanhood rooted in the wisdom of the French countryside. So he evokes the witch as fae, as the soul of the people, as a source of wisdom, as a healer, all of these kinds of things. The second figure is Margaret Murray, who's writing in the 1920s. Now, Murray is kind of the bête noire of academic historians, and I think she gets a pretty unfair rap, to be honest. She's an Egyptologist, a first wave feminist. You know, she goes so far through the glass ceiling, it's not true, you know, in a very, very different society. But she writes three books about witchcraft, and it's from her we get this idea of witchcraft as a pagan survival. Now, we all know that this isn't true. It was disproved very shortly after she first wrote her books. But the point is, if it wasn't very good history, and to be fair, she never pretended to be a historian. She was an anthropologist, and more importantly, an Egyptian, you know, Egyptologist, and an incredibly gifted one at that. if we take it as great art rather than as great history, we suddenly see how the archetype begins to shift. We get this idea that there is a counterculture rooted in the English countryside, you know, the death of a sacred king and William Rufus, one of these incredibly attractive, I think, countercultural figures, the metaphor of his blood dripping onto the floor of the New Forest as
Oh,
the people
yeah.
rather than the nobles take his body back in the cart. And it recommits the bond between the rulers and the ruled, the land and the people, the land and the king, all these kinds of things. So Murray is really great as an inspiration for lots of art, you know, for lots of works of art, lots of novels that then followed that all began to ground this idea of paganism and survivals in culture. The third figure is Gerald Gardner, and Gardner does the thing that Michelet could not. He takes the devil right out of the equation. So suddenly you have the witch as a source of female empowerment. That's from Michelet. You have the witch as a religious cultic figure that he gets from Margaret Murray, who is pagan. You know, historical witches were Christian, full stop, in Europe. You know, there are, you know, witches under Islam and Buddhism, et cetera, and in African tribal religions, but in a specifically Eurocentric context, they were Christian. And then Gardner takes away the devil and gives it form. So all of a sudden, you've jettisoned the objectionable stuff around witchcraft. And you've got the figure stepping into the limelight, shedding her rags, and becoming a viable figure to be emulated. As Gardner says, they were the bright young things of their age.
That's fantastic, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think for Amy, Gardner is her Oliver Reed, or maybe Alan.
Yeah. Well, that's understandable. I think there's a lot going on, and he's, you know, somebody I think is unfairly traduced. Actually, I've got a book in the presses for Cambridge University Press on him, and a little study of him on the Isle of Man as well. And Gardner is a remarkable figure, again, who is unfairly traduced for all kinds of reasons that you'll know about, Amy, I'm sure. Not least this dreadful trope that he's, you know, an elderly civil servant. Well, if Gardner was a civil servant, then he was a civil servant on a motorized launch tracing down opium smugglers and enforcing the opium trade in Malaya. And you know, the stock in trope about him doesn't fit the reality. You know, this is somebody who takes early retirement in his 50s when he gets back to England and immerses himself for the first time, because he's I think that the points I'm trying to make in the forthcoming books is Gardner didn't opt out of Western culture. He was never in it. He's somebody who has no formal education, is shoved from pillar to post by his awful governess, who ends up in the Far East and who encounters tribal religion firsthand. So he doesn't turn his back on Christianity because it's made no impact on him. So he's not this product of the empire. Conversely, he's somebody whose mind is like clay, and who goes out and sees seances, participates in them as a young man, experiences tribal religion not from some elevated anthropological, you know, pedestal, looking down upon this as inverted commas primitive religion, but as a living form of witchcraft, as a viable religion. Now, within that context, it's logical when, as you know, with his tribal tattoos and bangles and his suntan, when he rocks back into London with its chills and its frosty climates just before the Second World War, he starts looking for a religious experience that will mirror what he's seen in the Far East. And lo and behold, he kind of finds it and kind of creates it.
Makes a name.
Brilliant.
I'm fascinated by the religious aspect. If we can go into somebody again that I'm obsessed with, that Amy will know, which is Goya. So the Peninsular Wars and all these things that we know with his black paintings and all the trauma. But of course, the witch's Sabbath. Can we talk about this idea? Because you've got in more recent times Goya, but then if you look at Caravaggio and Artemisia Gentileschi, I can never say her name very well, but she was fabulous. With the sort of the Deuteronomy, we're looking at the Catholic Bible, I know, but with Judith and I always say Holofernes, but Holofernes, however you want to say it, Judith and Holofernes. This idea, again, I know that's not directly witchcraft, but the idea of she is slightly thought of in that way. And then of course Leviticus with the very famous quote, which you can tell us, John, because anybody, any fan of witchcraft or historian sort of worth their salt with witchcraft will know the Leviticus quote. But this idea of the kind of the biblical focus and then also going into art, I find extraordinary. And I know Goya is much more recent. And again, we touched on the original sort of sycophant Shakespeare. He was very talented, but he is the most talented sycophant because that guy was, I mean, get off James's lap. It's okay. Well, you can do something else. But I think this idea of the sort of witch kind of being immortalized, and I think Goya does it maybe in the most sort of gothic, but he's influenced by outside factors. Have you got, in one instance, a favorite painting or something maybe that you think encapsulates that, but also this continued fascination within art and anything, as soon as it becomes biblical, this sort of, again, fixation and focus, which I think is also slightly sexualized as well, because the Bible is quite sexualized. And I know maybe some listeners are going to hear that and get quite annoyed, but I mean, probably not if they're listening to our podcast, but I'm just. Your sort of view of this, I'll pass it over. Yeah, what do you think?
Well, to go back to Goya for an instant, he produces what is seen as the popular images of witchcraft because publishers love them, because it's very difficult to get good quality, terrific works of art in color for book dust jackets. So Goya performs that, instead of a woodcut, instead of an engraving, you've got actually an oil painting.
Do
But
you
actually, what,
I
go
should
on.
ask? Sorry,
Yeah,
continue.
but what Goya is trying to do is satirize witchcraft.
Yeah.
He's a man of reason. So he's trying to strip away the Catholic reaction, the return of the Inquisition in the wake of the Napoleonic period. So it's he does his engravings, he makes the Capriccios. He does his witchcraft paintings as a polemic in the name of the Age of Reason. If we look, then flip back to what he's working on, then everything, all roads lead back to Dürer. It's Dürer through his genius that works on the arch, because for every stereotype, and this is where we came in at the beginning, you need an archetype. So Dürer evokes the hag defying nature because her hair is blowing in the wrong direction of the wind, for instance. She's a weather witch on an astrological goat flying above the land. His four witches at the threshold with the devil peeking below them, as you say, they're naked. And ironically, to give an idea of class, he keeps them with their different turbans, with their hats that they'd have worn out on the street. So you know who the other three women are deferring to because she's got the poshest headgear, even though they're naked. So the witch gives you a sense of license. Now, Dürer, I think, is drawing witches for a popular market. Yes, his wife sells his prints in the marketplace at Nuremberg, but it's actually his pupil, Baldwin Guyenne, who, in a sense, corrupts the figure. It's Guyenne who really sexualizes the figure of the witch in a way that Dürer doesn't and brutalizes her. And then everything kind of flows on from that. If I had to pick, though, an artist, I think, who really works and sums everything up, it would be Salvador Rosa. And you can go into the National Gallery in London. And you can see his evocation of a Black Sabbath, where he throws everything into it, the knight, the figure of the gentry, supplicating himself before a hag, the veiled figures, the child sacrifice, the eldritch creatures leering out of the earth, the toads, the dismembered corpse who's having, nail parings taken for the spell that's being wrought in the magic circle. So Goya throws absolutely everything into this in the course of a few years in the 1640s, working out of a space in Italy where there really were not witch trials. Italian magic, where he is all about looking for treasure, or it's love magic. You don't get women going to the stake in the 1640s where Rosser is, for those, for those particular aspects of the crime. But he comes up with this amazing stuff out of his imagination and his enormous skill as an artist.
Extraordinary. And how much do you think? And sorry, Amy, last question, because I promise we'll
No,
pass
it's all
to
right.
King John here. Let's go to Shakespeare for obvious reasons. So apart from Jeanne d'Arc, but you look at things like The Tempest, how much do you think, in terms of him being in the public kind of narrative, do you think this sort of responsibility for the projection of witches right through to Disney, how much influence do you think that has come from maybe the likes of Shakespeare and things that are coming into the modern culture right through to Walt Disney? Who do you think is maybe perhaps most culpable for this idea of a witch as we would see it, maybe?
Well, Shakespeare is certainly there because he produces so many of them. You've got Macbeth as the great witch play. Then, of course, as we just said, you get Henry VI. You get The Tempest as part court mask. The idea, and this is where I don't, Shakespeare knows what sells. The crowd won a battle, but witchcraft sells both then and now. I think Shakespeare is somebody who didn't have to go overboard on the witch just to please the king in the way he did. And in some ways, you see, Prospero is really strange because Prospero is the magic worker who James VI and first would have feared above all others. If you read his demonology, it's the magus who really terrifies him. It's not the witch. She has to go as well. But it's the necromancer who James reserves his strongest sanction for. So Prospero is a really kind of off the wall creation who has to burn his books and abjure his art, of course, if he's going to live happily ever after and be reintegrated within that sphere. And there's so much going on in The Tempest. If you think that it's there to celebrate the marriage of the future Winter King and Queen of Bohemia, James's daughter and Frederick of the Palatine. And Frederick inspires, this marriage was supposed to be the chemical wedding. It was supposed to, in Star Wars terms, restore order for the Rosicrucians. You've got Comenius in Bohemia, who invests everything in it, this idea that you were going to have this triumph of reason and this new kind of esoteric world, and it ends appallingly in the fires of the 30 Years' War, which that sort of golden couple managed to trigger spectacularly through a combination of arrogance and just sheer bad luck. So we've got Shakespeare at the font of it, that keeps everything in everybody's mind. Of course, you've got Walt Disney, the palsied hands of the apple seller in the famous 1930s cartoon that he does so well that I think everybody's kind of storybook witch. And there again, this hones into what we were saying earlier, that the juxtaposition in that the wicked queen in that surrenders her beauty at the end and adopts the form of the crone. It's that terrifying sense of the woman who ages. You can see it in Bormann's Excalibur as well, over, Morgan Le Fay.
Oh, yeah.
So I think those are key. I think there's a genius in the Oz novels. After all, the author's mother-in-law was Jocelyn Gage, who wrote one of the great feminist accounts of witch hunting and
Okay.
demolitions of patriarchy. And, she's an abolitionist. She's on the left in America. She's a passionate feminist. She's all these kinds of things. So the Oz books benefit totally from her insights that she gave to her son-in-law. So you have, the good witches, the bad witches, the duality of magic in there, the light and the dark. I think the thing about the witches, every generation reinvents the figure.
Yeah.
So, for my generation in the 1980s, paganism and witchcraft was very much rooted in Kip Carpenter and Michael Praed and that iteration of Robin Hood, where
Yeah.
they're all in a coven, they're all pagans. If you look at that episode, The Lord of the Trees, there's nothing more Gardnerian pagan than that. Going and it went out at primetime TV. For the 90s generation, you've got Sabrina and then the
Yeah.
recent reboot. You've got the craft, you've got all of those kinds of things that we were talking about at the very start. And every generation takes the witch and reshapes her. We've been on a trajectory since Gardner where, by and large, whether it's the witches of Eastwick or Sabrina and her cat, it's favorable.
Yeah.
Nothing to say, though, that that couldn't turn back. And that's why, again, witchcraft lives in a strange symbiotic relationship with the European Enlightenment.
Yeah.
Modern paganism, modern witchcraft can only, I think, live, thrive, develop because of the toleration that is bought for them in fire and blood and suffering by Europe of the Enlightenment. Postmodernity is not going to give it to you because postmodernity legitimizes reason, and reason, leads to what happened in Bamberg and Loudun and Biddeford.
Yeah. Oh, it's sumptuous. I think the other sort of takeaway as well, without being too sort of flippant, is that there's a sort of narrative that maybe a man ages like a fine wine, and that a woman becomes the crone from Disney.
Absolutely. I would cut across though and say, because it's vaguely topical. I think totally that's true. And I think it's all that point. I mean, how many times do you see these awful, horrible things about somebody who was a pop star or an actress in their youth? And it's what look what they look like now,
Not
And yeah,
recognizing
because age gets us all, if you're a man, it's hair loss and beer guts, But this is just the decay that goes on in the human process. I'd say the wonderful example that cuts contrary to that was the late Marianne Faithfull. Because with Marianne, as somebody else once said, it's not my quote, so I can't claim it, but I wish I had said it, that there ought to be a graph that shows that as the Rolling Stones became less interesting, she became proportionately more interesting.
Yes.
And she
Yeah.
managed to tick all those boxes and, along with Anita Palgrave, defined as a witch. You look at Broken English, you've got witches' song, they talk about them. They were even decried by the Vatican in the early 70s as being witches for all those reasons. And you can see the way that the archetype is either embraced or thrown against you. And I'd say even more than that, just because I'm on a roll with Marianne at the moment,
Oh, always.
the urban myth about her and her deflowering chimed into all the visceral, unpleasant, male jilted fantasies you can ever think about that are similarly key to witchcraft allegations.
But it hasn't gone away, John, because the idea now, we maybe don't say witch, but perhaps nowadays they'd say a word that rhymes with it.
Yeah, yeah.
It's interesting that you say Marianne Faithfull. I wish that I sort of swooped in and said it so you wouldn't just think that I was fangirling you. But I know that obviously she died at the end of January. She's a marvel, and I just her voice and everything, and the fact that ever that she becomes known because of Mick Jagger, I think is such a tiresome thing because she was marvelous in her own right. And I think also the fact that she became, and not in that sort of Bloomsbury set way that is a little bit Marie Antoinette, but I think that she sort of disregarded her background in a way that I thought was delightfully bohemian. But I'm a massive Marianne Faithfull fan, just as I am Judy Christie, and I think both of them age so exquisitely and beautifully. And I find it very, very dull when someone goes, "You'd never know who they were; you wouldn't recognize them." Nonsense! They look beautiful then, and they look, you know. I mean, I know she's passed away, but she was gorgeous right to the end. Amy, I have hogged and fangirled and everything. Look, you must ask something before we sort of.
Yes, no. Just briefly, it was really interesting when you mentioned how Italy didn't really have witch trials in the same way that other places did. And that reminds, in Shropshire, a lot of, well, all of my research is focused on Shropshire, bit obsessed. But in Shropshire, we didn't really have witch trials. We had a few, but often it's very, very scant record-wise. Why do you think that some places, some regions or counties or even countries really had a focus on witch trials and it really took a big trajectory? And why in other places did it not really seem to be have the same impact? Is there a particular religious reason, or is it more to do with the individual cultures at play?
God, the $10,000 question.
Yeah, sorry.
I think, right, if we go around Europe, Spain doesn't have witch trials because the Inquisition are looking for different heretics. They're looking for Jewish people, they're looking for Muslims, they're looking for Protestants. They've got enough targets without striking on witches. Okay? Where you've got strong central government, it's less likely to happen than weak central government. Jim Sharp, who's another really brilliant witchcraft author, part of his thesis is about the fact that where the elites are fearful of losing power, they're more inclined to go along with the trials. When their power reasserts itself after the watershed of the mid-17th century, you don't see the number of accusations going down in England or anywhere else, but the prosecutions go down because the judiciary is feels itself safer. The Biddeford witches go to the scaffold and are hanged because English witches hang, they're never burned. They hang through sheer realpolitik because the Secretary of State thinks that they're a worthy sacrifice to the mob to keep the West Country quiet. You see it in the correspondence. They could have expected a pardon right up to the last end, but it's complete political expediency. I think you have to say that Sterne and Hopkins get away with it and flourish because of the complete breakdown of law and order in the wake of the Civil War, that they fill a vacuum, they have a narrative, they pursue pseudo-scientific reasoning for witchcraft. Borderlands, liminal spaces, Confranche, the Basque regions, the German principalities that can be really varied depending on, the particular confession, whether they're Catholic or Protestant, all these areas. So you can see in Bavaria, really late in the 1760s, there's a guy called Gassner who begins to heal and cast out demons. And he flourishes because he's got the protection of the local prince bishop. And it's actually the Pope and the Emperor who crack down on him because they don't want this sort of spread of enthusiasm. So there's 101 different reasons. I think instability, social tension, the plausibility of the people who are doing the prosecution. Shropshire, of course, you've got the amazing John Holt, who I'm working on a book on.
Oh, wow, are you?
Holt,
That's cool.
happy now.
Yeah.
Holt just has to be one of my heroes because he turns, you see, he breaks witch hunting. This is to jump ahead. He takes the fear out of it. particularly in the case of Southwark, with the delightfully named Mrs. Moorduck or Moordyke, depending how you which pamphlet you listen to, where suddenly he cannot overturn witch belief in the law because, and this is another reason why it happens. What is the ultimate source of authority for Christendom? It's the Bible. What is it in the Bible? Well, it's the Curse of Leviticus, the Witch of Endor, Moses, and the Pharaoh's magicians, etc., etc. There are witches in the Bible, full stop, and the devil. So to say that witches do not have power was always termed atheistical. You know, that's what Glanville is saying in the 1670s, just before the Biddeford Witches. That's one of the big justifications. John Wesley was a great believer in witchcraft because he said, if you take the witches out of the Bible, what have you got left? So, but Holt subverts it by altering the onus of proof that if you are seen as a fraudulent accuser, you can be in for really big trouble. So he has the young tough, the apprentice, a sort of Tommy Robinson of his age,
Oh God.
gone through the City of London. You know, he
Yeah.
has him done as somebody who is causing a disturbance, is privatizing violence, and Holt's big bêtes noires are violence, violence against women, violence against minorities, and mob violence when it happens to be allied to military power. And in Southwark, all of those things kick off, and he breaks the Southwark mob, and he breaks the soldiers and the apprentices who perpetrate this. And after that, people who are going to bring, particularly young men who are going to bring witchcraft accusations, have to be prepared if it goes wrong for them, that it's not going to be, you know, Mrs. Moorduck who's in the pillory, or fined or whipped. It's going to be them. So the balance of terror alters thanks to Holt, and Holt acquits and acquits and acquits again in his 13 famous trials, a couple of which were up in Shropshire.
No, that's
So
really interesting.
I think as well, you could go into looking at, I'm just thinking about a Shropshire case. They've got other things to worry about. It's a mixed area. There isn't the Puritan domination there is in the eastern counties. You know, in the Civil War, it had been under royalist control. So there are lots of different things happening there. You know, the problem in Biddeford arises because the traditional elites who were Puritan who had been kicked out of office. And this small, fragile Tory Anglican minority get into power and they go along with the witch hunt as a means of maintaining their power in a town that hates them.
I think if anything was the rue for a witch hunt, it would be a Tory Anglican. Because like not only someone that you wouldn't want to meet down an alleyway, but also they sound like somebody who's exactly the type that's going to be, you know, if you said, well, I'm going to be honest, they're a Tory Anglican, you're like, oh, well, I think I've seen the problem. But look, John, we could talk to you forever. I'm aware we've taken up so much of your evening, but God, I'm fangirling like crazy, shamelessly, as anyone who listens to this episode will know, because you've covered Oliver Reed, which is Marianne Faithfull, Goya, everything. So I'm obsessed. Amy, as I have just asked so many questions, have you got anything you want to ask before we let John enjoy what's left of his evening?
So bit of a random one, but if you so what would be your favorite folkloric creature or character or kind of trope within folklore? Mine in probably is the Sasquatch, but I'm partial to a black dog folklore. I love a ghost, and I love also anything water-based. So in Shropshire, we've got a lot of mermaids, despite the fact we're nowhere near the sea. So what would be your kind of big three folkloric creatures?
Wow. Something that's off the top of my head, going back to your black dog, I love the black dog of Peel on the Isle of Man. And that's just because I'm Manx, and you know, it's this whole, it's just the local story. You know, Gerald Gardner picks up on it, comes from Waldron, who was a customs agent in the 18th century, who does this amazing compendium of folklore, and Waldron sticks everything together. I think the fascinating thing about him is, A, he has no witches in a Manx context. He throws everything into the pot except for witches. But you get the phonogery out of him, who is a kind of pan figure, you know, goat-footed, who supposedly bands around the Manx countryside. You get the fae that the Manx have aplenty. So, you know, if you ever go over the ferry bridge to this day, the little announcement on the bus is everybody has to say, "Hello, fairies,"
Oh, that's
to go
brilliant.
over the bridge, or you're in trouble, you know. And then you've got the mermaids, and Waldron has this fascinating thing that he collects these stories off the Manx, but he historicizes them, and a lot of them are to do with the civil wars. The Black Dog of the Peel of Peel is from the 1660s, and he talks about, because the Isle was one of the last places to have a royalist garrison in the Civil War. It holds out until 1651. And then very sensibly, the Manx surrender as soon as the invasion fleet rock up. You know, they do the sensible thing, and kick over the traces. But he has this beautiful passage where he talks about when the island was cut off and there wasn't the foreign trade with Ireland and England, and it was blockaded by the Parliamentary Navy. The mermen and the merwomen came out of the waves, and they could be found in the secluded beaches by moonlight, combing out their hair and playing in the shallows.
Oh,
And
wow.
it's such a beautiful lyrical image. I think that's one of my favourites.
Oh, wow, that's wonderful.
Yes, it's got sort of, it's giving kind of chin and nogue and all this kind of thing, isn't it? Just, oh, just, yeah, heaven. So John, look, I'm sure we have accosted you for long enough and I could talk to you forever.
Same.
Yeah, I know. But look, thank you so much. And I hope you'll join us again if we can. Well, we're going to
It's been an
find an
absolute pleasure, and well, yeah, I'd love to.
I hope so. We'll find an excuse to sort of, coach you back on, and hopefully you'll be willing. But thank you so much. We've just, yeah, it's been a blast. And I never say this, but actually, I think you probably are my favorite guest. So, and I'm sorry to other guests, but tough. It's true. So thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
Brilliant. Thank you. And thank you to our listeners. Amy, anything you want to add?
Just thank you. Yeah. It's been great.
As I say, it's a real pleasure. And you know, it's lovely to get intelligent questions and you know, an engaged conversation. It's wonderful. Oh,
Thank you.
I am thrilled. Thank you. So that was, again, that's gone straight to my head. So thank you so much. Brilliant. Thank you so much. We'll see you all again. Thank you.
Cheerio. Have a lovely night.
Thank you.
Bye.